Okay, we'd like to start the next session, which is to hear from our Office of Research and Analysis on a working paper with regard to restatements of financial statements, and I'm going to turn this over to Marty Bauman. Marty is the director of our Office of Research and Analysis, and he will introduce the two presenters. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, Tom. As Tom said, I'm the director of the PCAOB's Office of Research and Analysis, and I'm pleased to introduce to my right the office's chief economist, Steve Byers, and our senior economist, Yana Hraniova. In a moment, they will be presenting for discussion and consideration their working paper, Studying Changes in Market Responses to Financial Statement Restatement Announcements in the Sarbanes-Oxley Era. The Office of Research and Analysis is charged with, among other things, assessing the risk of material misstatements in audited financial statements. In this effort, the office supports the board and the efforts of the PCAOB's inspections and standard-setting activities. The office developed and maintains a comprehensive restatement database for a variety of analytical and also predictive purposes. Our chief economist's office determined that this database could also be useful in assessing how the stock market was reacting to restatements. This effort led to the paper that will be discussed today. It's important to note that this research is at a, quote, working paper stage. In the normal course, economists would circulate the working paper at academic seminars, meetings, etc., and then submit the paper to an academic journal, which would ask others to peer review it. Comments and input from the peer reviewers would help the authors further advance and improve the research before the journal would accept it for publication. So while Steve and Yana will be submitting this research for such peer review, we felt that we should also seek comment and input on the research from this standing advisory group. Also, because of the role of the PCAOB, we wanted to ensure that the research, even at this preliminary stage, was exposed by us and that it didn't become public in some other fashion. So with that said, I'll ask Steve and Yana to present their research.
Well, thank you very much, Marty. We've found out that there's no shortage of opinions on this area, so we think it'll be a lively discussion. This paper was really an offshoot of some other research we're doing, and we thought we might be able to garner some insight into if Sarbanes-Oxley or the events surrounding it have impacted the market's reaction to financial restatements. And at first glance, it appears that it does. And we recognize that we may have to do some additional estimation and correction for some assumptions, but we think we can get somewhere with this conclusively. So, are market responses to restatement announcements different in the periods before and after the enactment of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2000? Mind you, we just chose Sarbanes-Oxley as a dividing line, but we started to see this phenomenon as early as Enron, which when the Department of Justice began its investigation in Enron, which was in January 2001, I believe, or early 2002. So we haven't identified the point yet where this phenomenon began. And some people have speculated it may have started clear back with Reg FD or maybe with the issue of SAS 99. So that remains to be seen. But if things have changed, how have they changed? Has market efficiency and price volatility due to restatements been impacted? The meaning of a restatement announcement in our paper, we're not talking about a restatement per se. Some of the observations we had in this database actually came through financial filings, 10-Ks, 10-KAs, et cetera, and some of them came through just press releases or an 8K that did not provide any additional information such as we're restating or we think we might have a problem in a particular area. So the first public announcement really captures is a publication date or a filing date that either captures a restatement reveals an intent to restate or discusses a concern. And we left concern in this paper because there's a variety of ways that companies have alluded to the fact they think they might have a problem. So here is a slide that depicts the split date in the data. So what we had was a whole database of restatements going from 1998 to 2005. And it was a particular type of restatements. It's not all restatements, and we'll describe that subset of restatements in a minute. What we did not seek to determine was whether or not the act, Sarbanes-Oxley, caused a change in the market's reaction to these restatement announcements. We just merely used it as a dividing line. We mentioned that we're considering moving that around. Here's our $5 or our $50 million slide, however you want to look at it. But hopefully you can see it. It's, when I presented this in the past, I could stand up and point things out. So if you have a question, let me know. The slide, the panel on the left, is shows the abnormal returns after we've removed the market effect on stock prices for these companies that have had financial restatements. The panel on the left is the period pre-SOX, so prior to July 30th, 2002. You'll see three colors of time series there. You've got a blue line, a black line, and a red line. The blue line shows the positive market reaction to restatement announcements. The black line shows those that statistically were insignificant. In other words, we could not statistically prove that the movement in the stock price or the return on the stock that day was a result of the announcement of the restatement. So we said those were insignificant restatements. The red line shows the negative market reaction. So prior to SOX, about 4% of restatement announcements were followed by a positive market reaction. No market reaction was 75%, so three-quarters of these the market was not reacting to, and negative market reactions about 21%. If you go to the right-hand panel, same color designation, but you'll see quite a difference both in the width of the positive and negative restatements. And what we saw here was an increase in the number or the percentage of positive market reactions. It went up about 1.7%. And the insignificant market reactions soared to 83.8%. The negative market reactions went down to 10.3%. Now, what this resulted in was that the magnitude of negative market responses to restatements has decreased by 71%. What we're saying here is if you look at the red time series on the left panel, that the change from day zero, and if you can see, if you look in the middle of the panel where you see the big drop in the time series, that's at day zero. What we're depicting here is the 20 days prior to the restatement announcement date and the 20 days after. Don't be confused for the academics in here. We did estimate a market model for this over, 120 days prior to this, so that we got a good estimate for the market response. So at day zero, you see day zero, we saw an initial response, and then on the day one, which is the day after the day of the announcement, we saw another response. The reason we chose those 2 days is this. Some of the restatement announcements came, you know, after 4:30 or 5 o'clock, or overnight they were released. So we said if we really want to see the true impact, we need to look at day zero and the following day. So the negative market reactions decreased by 71%. The positive market reactions also decreased by 33%. And you'll notice that the post-announcement market reaction exhibits decreased volatility. What that means is if you look at the time series on the left-hand panel, they move around a lot. And if you're familiar with standard deviation or variance, you'll see that there is a higher variance in the time series in the left-hand panel. And this is statistically shown. We did the appropriate test to determine this. That there's less volatility in the stock prices of these companies that have announced restatements post-SOX. And this has led us to make a comment that, well, you know, why is that? And we want to get information for you guys as to why you think that might be the case. Any questions at this point before we go on? Okay.
Galen Hansen. period of time did you go? How far out does this go? Where was your cutoff point?
Are you talking about how far out we went after the restatement announcement?
Yeah, how far are you looking into restatements? How far out since SOX was adopted?
Oh, okay. Our cutoff line was the restatement announcements in the left-hand panel, the pre-SOX,
right,
go from 1998 to July 30th, 2002. Okay? From in the post-SOX, we've got going from August, is there 31 days in July? August 1st to the end of 1995. Okay.
2005.
Or not 1995, 2005. So we've got about 3 years post.
So none of these pick up any of the backdating issues that we've seen in the last couple of years.
No. And now's probably a good time to talk about the. Maybe I'll let Yana talk about this. She wants about no, but
Zavanna Pomeros.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt your flow, but since you said this was the $50 million slide, can we pose questions on this slide? Is that appropriate now?
Yes, sure.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to masquerade as an academic for just a couple minutes, but I decline to masquerade as an old one, as Joe said this morning. And I just wanted to start out with sort of an academic approach to this because I wanted to end with really a public policy question, but to get there through an academic route. And one of the things that academics do when they look at papers like this is they start out asking, what's the research question? And it seemed to me that the research question here was a little bit broader than has been described on the slide, and that was you were seeking to try to determine whether investor confidence has changed post-SOX. In other words, do we have greater investor confidence in the post-SOX era than we did in the pre-SOX era or some time frame around that? And I think that's an enormously important question. However, it's a very difficult question to address. And it's hard for me to think about using restatements to address that question, a market reaction to restatements to address that question. So while I think it's an enormously important question, it just is a very difficult one to address. That isn't to say that restatements themselves might not have interesting questions within them. Of course, heaven knows, I've personally thought that they did. And as Joe talked about, people have to publish to meet academic criteria, so that's some of what I've been doing as part of our academic incentive system. But when we do these papers, we also ask about the methodology, and so one of the things we would ask about is, you know, the approach that you're taking to addressing market reaction. And there's a large literature that talks about market reaction to restatements. And there's a number of variables that influence market reaction to restatements, none of which are reflected in this paper. This paper is simply a univariate analysis of market reaction to restatements pre and post-SOX. You can't say anything about market reaction unless you control for these other factors. So I would really urge you to reconsider this paper in light of the existing research that looks at so many other factors that influence market reaction. And one of those things that influence them is, I mean, when you think about why would there be positive reaction to restatement announcements, and you tend to think about that as not good news, well, a number of these restatements are announced in conjunction with other information. And none of this is controlled for here in this study. So this slide that you have up here on the screen doesn't control for anything else that influences restatements, including whether or not they were released with other information and controlling for that other information. And that leads me to the point of this slide, which basically, if you look at it, it says 75% of these restatements pre-SOX are statistically insignificant, which implies that they don't matter, and 84% of them post-SOX. I just find it really curious that the PCAOB would come out with a paper that says restatements don't matter. I think that given what we're talking about here, and I've taken an academic approach to this, remember, these papers go through an academic peer review process that often the results change as a result of that peer review process. They're very lengthy. They can take 2 to 3 years, and they come out in a very significantly different place. And I guess I just worry, one, I wonder why the PCAOB is coming out with a paper that really undermines what it is they're trying to do in terms of discourage misstatements and restatements by implying they don't matter. And then the second thing is, can they really tolerate this kind of peer review process that has to be willing to significantly change findings? And is that the best use of resources? Thank you.
Well, thanks for that comment. Some of what you said we certainly have considered, and some of what you say is true. We have stumbled onto the fact that in the short time since this paper has unveiled itself, that we've had a lot of comments very similar to yours, and I think one of the problems in the paper is we haven't accurately described what we have controlled for. And so just briefly, I'll let you know that we will describe better what we have controlled for, and rest assured that what the reason this restatement database is much smaller than, say, what you would have seen in the Glass-Lewis, the GAO report, is we looked for restatement announcement dates where the only bit of information that was in that restatement announcement database, with the exception of the 10K filings and the 10Q types of things, was that there was just a restatement, that there was just a problem or a concern in the restatements. Now, so we're looking into that, and it'll be fairly clear in 2 or 3 years, so thanks.
Damon Silvers?
After Savannah's coming, I'm a little lost for words. But one question that I don't understand in relation to this chart is that in many points in the paper you say that you don't see any sign of pre-event information leakage, and yet I can see how that would be consistent with the post-SOX graph of the statistically insignificant market reactions. You see that in the post-SOX universe, the whole population basically flatlines in terms of abnormal returns, but in the pre-SOX graph, it's not right. You've got a secular downturn for the whole population, since what you're measuring is abnormal returns, I don't see how that's consistent with the assertion that there's not leakage. And it seems to me this, if I'm not making a mistake here, that this is quite relevant to Zavanna's point about other variables and other things that are going on. There are many different, very different sort of narratives in relation to restatements. And if there's different sort of sequencing in terms of the mix of information that the market is reacting to when the restatement hits, right, and there is leakage, right? That not leakage about the restatement itself, but leakage about a series of problems which the restatement is embedded in, then that would seem to cast doubt on the ability to use this data. This downward trend lines would seem to suggest that's what's going on. The second thing I would say, which may be somewhat more sort of positive in relation to this study, is that it's, and I'd like you to react to it, is that it strikes me that this study would seem to suggest that, and would be consistent with a theory, which was that pre-SOX, restatements were unusual enough, and investor confidence in the audit process was low enough that investors would tend to view a restatement as a signal of impending catastrophe, and would feel that they didn't have very much information to really assess what it meant, and that post-SOX that has diminished, right? That one could read that out of this. But I would agree though with Zavanna that it seems to me that this is sort of intellectually inadequate to the full that this paper, as an analysis of the full role of restatements around investor confidence and information mixes, is intellectually inadequate because there's simply it's simply not a rich enough story about what goes on around them and what they're embedded in. And in particular, that terms like statistically insignificant, which are, I think, understood in the community of academics, may tell us, maybe somewhat misleading, that without giving that rich story, right, that you have a paper that is misleading in relationship to the role of the process of monitoring financial statements and drawing out the role that restatements play. And I hope I'm sort of trying to express a concern that I think is hard to flesh out fully without sort of more data.
Well, Paul, you want one more question?
Christy Wood.
From an investor's point of view, I just wondered that given this environment has been one of that your study is one of persistent declining volatility. How do you control for that? And because volatility declined in the prior, if you think about SOX, middle of 2002, volatility declined precipitously for the ensuing 4.5 years until this summer. And then in the environment prior to that, you had both a radical sort of rise in late 90s and then the bear market. And I just think that I was wondering, A, did you control for it, and how did you control for it, and how can you extrapolate that from the study?
Thank you. If we have time, we'll after we get the rest of the questions, we can talk about that. So.
Lynn, did you have a question? I just thought your card was up. Sorry. Dick Dietrich?
Well, that is true, and we felt like we controlled for that as much as we possibly could, because when you calculate abnormal returns, you're trying to remove the impact of the overall markets from the individual stock price reaction of a company, or the returns from the company. If you remove the overall market impact, think of it as of the normal return of the company. If you do that, you've taken out the volatility of the stock market itself. Now, we know we can't control it for that completely, but we recognize the problem.
So just to be clear, the volatility part study that you did, was it cap weighted, you're saying? What's the part that's cap weighted? What's the part that's cap weighted?
I may be misunderstanding what we said, but when you calculate abnormal returns, you try and remove the stock price reaction or the total return of that particular company's stock price on a given day by basically neutralizing its beta associated with the market. So if you do that, you could infer that you're taking out the volatility of the market from that individual company's return that day or over the period you're studying.
I think to answer that, I think this is intended to be the abnormal return, not the you've taken out the.
It's not the total return. These are abnormal returns that are just specific to the company over and above how it would have responded given overall movements in the market over this period. If you'd like, I'd talk to you afterwards. So.
Dick Dietrich?
No, thank you. I think what I'd like to leave you with is a question that can be considered a rhetorical question, but I think it might really help you in thinking about this. If you think about a restatement, and I think this gets to Zavanna's point, what is it in the restatement that you think causes investors to react? One possibility is the restatement itself. That would raise Damon's question, which is, can someone project that a restatement is likely to be announced? And there are a number of signals that can give credence to that. The firing of a CFO, for example, the delay of financial statements release. There's lots of messages that come out. So as you think about the downward drift that it obtains in your sample on the left for the positive reaction companies at the time of the announcement itself, there clearly could be things that are presaging the announcement of the restatement. Secondly, restatements are very different in the ways that they operate. I saw a restatement that was performed as an amendment to a 10K that was solely to change a parenthesis in the statement of cash flows. Now, certainly, a restatement like that would be very different than one where the company was announcing that the last 5 years of earnings were all made up. And so one of the possibilities would be, and if you look at the series back before 1998, you'll find that there were relatively few restatements that obtained. Now, one possibility is because there were actually no errors in financial reporting prior to 1998. But having spoken with somebody who was a chief accounting officer for a Fortune 50 company, he said, are you kidding? He said, look at a restatement that was recently done by General Electric. And, John, I'll let you correct me on the numbers. But his numbers were it was like a $100 million restatement on a company that had $20 billion of earnings. And he said, we would never have restated that at an earlier point in time. And so getting back again to Zavanna's comment, it may be that if you think again about the pathology of what it is that's causing investors to react, that investor reactions are different post-SOX because the kinds of restatements that are being announced have differences in their pathology post-SOX. And that, I think that's what Zavanna's point was really getting to, is you've really got to tease these things out and find out what other factors are going on and what it is that you would expect investors to be responding to. And that may help you to understand why you're getting positive adjustments in some cases, negative adjustments in other cases. And I suspect that the academics around the room can really have a lot of other detailed comments for you about things that only make sense to academics. But we can do that offline.
There's one thing we probably should answer and explain right now, and that is about this restatement database. We built our own restatement database because what we were trying to do, and we mentioned this in the paper, was we excluded restatements that weren't related to changes in the financial statements due to change in errors or mathematical mistakes, improper application of GAAP or fraud. So none of these restatements in this study include anything for, I'd like to let John Ameren. The long and short is we controlled for
accounting errors.
As best you could. It's just for accounting errors, not what you might consider these other, not frivolous, but more, I don't even know what you'd call it, like your parentheses change. None of that is in this restatement database. And a parenthesis changes?
That would be included. Accounting, the restatement database here is for accounting errors, and what I think Steve's trying to say is certain restatements for other things like a change in accounting principle are not included, or a stock split or something is not included. It's for accounting errors.
I think what we're trying to say is that we understand that there's lots of subtleties among the set of things that will fall into your database. We also understand that there's lots of things that would not fall into your database, and appropriately so. So the issue really is that restatements aren't always the same, even if they all fall in within the class of errors or irregularities.
Ted White.
Thank you. I, for one, like what you've done, and I would encourage you to continue this tact and put resources toward this. I think this is a fascinating question. I fully recognize the challenges in the methodology, particularly given the topic. I think it's very true that each one of these situations is different. You could have the exact type of restatement in a different company with a different set of circumstances and have different impact. In the aggregate, I find this meaningful. And I, for one, I don't view it as negative that you have post your cutoff point a larger percentage that are found statistically insignificant. In fact, I actually view that opposite, in that I think part of what, you know, building and maintaining investor confidence is an understanding that there's a robust mechanism to cause restatements and keep this train on the track, and that, you know, there's a few different ways to look at that type of information. As far as, you know, recommendations to supplement this and get at what is very different situations, I mean, I would suggest maybe you look at some case studies around restatements in both the pre and post, including interviews with folks that are close to it and looking at, you know, the street research around these types of things, trying to put into context what the situation at the company is. That will be very hard to do, in my opinion, but I think it's somewhat meaningful in that, you know, the same types of restatements are likely to affect each situation differently, but there's probably some information in here that helps supplement and fill in the voids in what this methodology would naturally leave.
I'd like to just ask Steve a question, because I think it might answer a question raised by you, Dick, and some others. The positive market reaction post a restatement would seem to be a surprise to most. But I think that a very large percentage, Steve, am I right, maybe 50% or so, or some number in that neighborhood, were actually announced, the restatement was actually announced in the 10-K, stealth restatement, where the numbers were there at the same time as the restatement announcement. And therefore, the reader was not only hearing about a restatement, but was actually seeing the results at the exact same time, which may have been improved financial results than they otherwise had seen before.
Well, there's another possibility here, and I don't remember who brought this up, but if you look at the left-hand panel, there was this drifting down prior to the announcement date in the pre-SOX era. And one thing Yana and I have wanted to look into and get some help on is, if you think about pre-SOX, that there was this tendency from companies to not want to announce a restatement at all costs until they were forced to, okay? But that there was other information coming out prior to our 20-day window here, or even during that period, that allowed the street or Wall Street and so forth to infer that, gosh, something doesn't seem right. So there's this pessimistic trend downward. And post-SOX, there's been more of a tendency, we've surmised, for companies to come out and go ahead and say, well, we're not going to sweep this under the rug for a long time. We're going to come out and make the announcement right away. So we think that the absence of that downward drift is really the fact that disclosure is coming sooner from the company through a restatement or an announcement of it. We don't have proof of this yet, of course, but we're surmising. And did I answer your question, Marty, in a way?
In a way, but it is correct that a vast number of these are actually stated in the first time in a 10-J.
For instance, yes, that's true. A little under 50% of them were in the post-SOX era.
So I think that's a situation where the investor has the numbers at the exact same time that they have the restatement, which could therefore evoke a response different than you might think someone just simply announcing a restatement would evoke. I think the next question was from Vin Coleman.
Thanks, Marty. Maybe just a couple questions that are a little bit similar, just because I think it's in your last paragraph where you're talking about, you know, more work in the characteristics. Perhaps two questions around the characteristics when you're talking about your database. One would be around the nature of the restatement. I think it's been touched upon here, right? A restatement of revenue may be very different than a technical restatement around the hedge accounting derivatives that became very common that had nothing to do with cash, as an example. Or, you know, you can go to, or a restatement of cash flows. Or, so they're just viewed differently. And I think that's in your characteristic statement here. And I was wondering, so that's question one. And then question two is, did you also consider the materiality? There's been discussions, quite a bit of discussions, around the relative materiality of the restatements, and wanted to know whether or not, you know, you took that into account. Because I think if you go up a level, I also like this from the standpoint of, and if you continue to move forward, the reality is right now the number of restatements of large issuers, if you think about whether SOX was positive or not, is actually coming down for anybody who's really analyzing this. And interestingly enough, for the smaller
registrants, the number of restatements is actually increasing. And so there was a dynamic going on during this period. You know, we were just talking amongst ourselves. I'm not surprised, by the way, Marty, with the positive, because it's interesting, is it's now behind you. So there was an announcement, the restatement happens, it's now behind you, and everybody moves on, and people feel better and more confident about it. So there's a dynamic going on in the last 4 years that was very unique, which I think needs to be built into the characteristics, which I think would be very useful. I'm just wondering if you took characteristics and materiality.
We did not take materiality. We have been considering ways to try and look at how was the market response in this context related to the size of the restatement, which I think is what you're referring to. Some people have tried to do that before, and it's I think it's a difficult thing to do because involved in certain you'll see in restatements multiple reasons for the restatements. And so that leads to the characteristics as well. We did take Glass-Lewis's categories for restatements. They had 12 broad categories. And we did some frequency distribution analysis on that for this study to see if there was anything pre- or post-SOX different in the characteristics for what people were restating for. And there's nothing that stands out to you glaringly that says these certain kind of restatements are causing more positive market reactions and these are causing more negative, any different than they were prior to SOX. So we are looking into that. We haven't pursued it entirely yet, but we are going to – we've got some of that information, yes.
So these this includes really all restatements for accounting errors, whether they be, as you said, technical or whether they be a restatement for revenue. It excludes companies that aren't on the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, so that's a population of companies that excludes. So it includes only larger companies.
Well, the only reason I'm bringing it up is when a restatement's going out and we're involved in it, we have a pretty good sense, and we're getting pretty good at knowing whether or not there's going to be a reaction or not. And generally, it's materiality in the nature.
I think Tom Linsmeyer was next.
I think it's always interesting to look at data, but I think there are several issues that I think could help you focus on your research questions a little bit better. It seems to me you're asking questions about restatements and the impacts of restatements. I think there's two things with your sample that confound that a little bit that I find somewhat troublesome. I don't understand why you include as an event date dates in which there were concerns related to accounting that preceded the restatement. That market reaction, to me, talks about concerns about accounting, not about the effect of having a restatement. And so I don't know whether that ought to be included in the sample if what you're primarily concentrating on is restatement effects. Second of all, when there are restatements that are stealth restatements within 10-Ks or 10-Qs, there's much more information that's being communicated to the market about the economics of the company through the other information in those Ks and Qs. So I think you're going to have a problem attributing that market reaction to just the restatement. And you might want to cut your sample at least to see what happens if you drop those. I concur with everyone in this analysis that the context of the nature of the restatements are going to be very important to opening up this black box and understanding what we're seeing in the data. So the types of restatements and whether they vary in pre- and post-periods I think are very important. Statistics about the magnitudes of the adjustments to earnings or stockholders' equity before and after and whether that changes. I think a correlation of the magnitude of the stock price to the magnitude of the earnings reported in those restatements or the shift is very important to try to say and tease out whether the reaction is to the restatement adjustment itself and the implications that a revised earnings might have for your belief about the future prospects of the company, from saying a restatement could be problematic because it indicates that the quality of management's controls or the quality of management itself and its system are something different. So I don't know that there's a problem if you don't find a correlation, but it might tell you something differently about what that reaction is to. What surprised me more than anything is, in that post period, I don't see separated out the restatements that were driven by PCAOB inspections. It's very possible that, I would think that would be of interest to you, and I also think it's possible that if what those restatements are 200 companies having to do something with leases, I don't think that's the number, but there was a lease problem early on, that the market reaction to having 200 companies having to adjust for a lease change is not going to imply much about the management itself. That was a flaw in the system. And it might not say anything about real material errors, and you might get a different sort of reaction to those sorts of restatements that only exist in the post period than they do in the pre period. I think teasing that out would be very interesting. Finally, you do want to say something about variability. And I don't think this is the most powerful way to look at variability. One way, or confidence. You might want to be, Zovana said there might be some belief as to whether there's confidence. I don't think you can get investor confidence, but you might be able to want to tease out whether they're in the post period greater or less disagreement about what earnings means to investors. And the way that one metric that you can look at to try to see whether or not there is disagreements or lack of similarity in beliefs about what they mean is look at trading volume around earnings announcements in the post periods and see if they change differently. That's a better way to be able to tease out disagreement or investors all thinking the same way to the same piece of information.
Lynn Turner.
I think as the academics are pointed around the table, you got your work cut out for you, because I think it is very difficult. My experience is we went through the restatements of Glass-Lewis. It was very, very difficult to figure out why or what drove people's reaction in the marketplace to restatements. For example, you did have 250 to 300 leasing restatements, and almost from the get-go sense, when you talk to analysts about it, they concluded that since everyone was doing it, and you compare on a peer-to-peer type basis, it was a thing of a nature that most PMs and analysts really don't understand all that well. It was just let it go unless there was some surprise in it with respect to information on the leases that were going to hit the cash flows in the future. So when we talked to them on that, just universally, they turned around and gave them a pass regardless of how big or small it was. On some of the option backdating, and you said this doesn't cover it, I know on RIM came out and announced a restatement, and their stock shot up exponentially. And the reason it did, notwithstanding a serious option backdating problem, was because at the same time they announced the restatement, they also announced a really good quarter for BlackBerry and that things were looking really up. And what we found with the restatements was with increasing incidences, when companies would announce a restatement, they also put it in with other information that was very positive. So people were packaging a very positive piece of information with what was otherwise negative, and it was not unusual to see stock go jump up. On the other hand, if you had a restatement and it looked like the CEO was going to go, that was those that would tend to go the other way. But the packaging, and it just seemed like more and more often we saw it where people were picking up a good piece of news and going with it. On that basis, the restatements on cash flows, of which there's a whole group in here, since it didn't change anything on the overall cash flow of the company, the typical analyst
didn't care, as strange as that may seem, because even if it moved it from operating down into a financing or vice versa, just in general, because it was still on the same financial statement and just a matter of which line you went to, even though that was probably very significant in terms of was this something that was really recurring as operating or not, they tended to just ignore those. The other thing, and I think Vinny actually picked up something very good here to go back and look. If you look at the category, well, better lucky than right, huh, Vin? You know? So, that's my partner, former partner. Okay. But anyway, if you look at the restatements, pre-SOX, we really didn't have the things as much like cash flow. You certainly didn't have the derivative stuff, which the analysts have never understood. We had a lot more pre-SOX in terms of the percentage of these that were revenue recognition, no question about it. Post-SOX, the revenue recognition ones have dropped significantly as a percentage of the whole thing. I mean, big time. And so the ones like that, which do tend, without a doubt, you know, remember, Dick, this from our state when we were at the commission, revenue recognition are the ones that tend to move things more so than other ones. Those became a much smaller piece of them post-SOX, and that could be impacting this significantly as well. And so I just suggest, as difficult as this is to do, and I do know it's extremely difficult, it's important that you be able to go in and dig in and look at all of those, and that's really what I'm hearing some of the academics say around here. The other piece of it, though, that is also of keen interest to me is, Steve, you and Marty indicated these are all what we'd all consider to be errors. So I'm assuming that is they just didn't comply with GAAP. I'd be interested in knowing and seeing in the paper if that's the case, because I think what got us into the problem that we did with the corporate scandals for the most part, even in big cases like Enron, you see where people start out initially with small errors that then got bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time we got to then Chairman Leavitt's speech in September of 98, he talked about the culture of gamesmanship with these type of adjustments, where we were letting people get by with adjustments that we knew were wrong, that people weren't following GAAP, and yet we were giving them passes. And there's been companies like McDonald's and others that have been cited as prime examples of that. Waste Management was one of those. W.R. Grace was one of those. But we created that culture that said, it's fine, you can have errors, you can do the accounting wrong, but unless it's big enough, and in Waste Management it even got up to 10 to 12%, and they said, yeah, it's quantitatively big, but it's qualitatively immaterial. And there we'll give a pass on it. And yet that created the culture that got us into trouble during the scandals, because as those became bigger, people went down the slippery road and then triggered us into these others. And I think you need to discuss in the paper that and the concept that we've had a behavioral change to where post-SOX, especially with the certifications, people, and I think correctly so, are much more of the mindset, let's go get it right, rather than passing. So you've got instances where people are correcting things now that pre-SOX they never would have corrected, and there's really no discussion of that whole thing in this paper at all, and it really doesn't address what I consider to be ultimately the real question here with all this research, and that is, do you want to go back to the culture of gamesmanship we had before we made that cultural change? And you need to answer, is that what you're advocating in this paper? And I think you should conclude and say, are you advocating that in this paper? Because there's some people, including, I believe, some people on the SEC Complexity Committee, that are saying, in essence, this is the evidence for supporting that type of going back to that culture.
I just have a brief comment. Is I'm feeling pretty good about this now because Jana and I are going to do the rest of our research from an undisclosed location. Well, you know, this is a very difficult area, and being economists, and I think maybe at a bit of a disadvantage of not being accountants that are researchers in accounting and so forth, is we really were just looking to see is, has something changed? And, in fact, when we came up with this, our might be a $20 slide now, we're not sure, but when we came up with our slide, we recognized that something's going on here. And the thing that I've been advocating to folks at the PCOB is, look, we've started a discussion that I hope a whole bunch of researchers and other interested parties out there will latch onto, and they'll answer the questions for us. So it's never been our intention to be the experts or answer all the questions here, but I hope that people will take this and kind of launch forward with it. I think there's value in that. So,
good. Joe Carzella?
Yeah, most of the points that I was going to make have already been made. There's just two other things you might want to at least think about. Steve, and maybe these aren't issues, but your sample combines two databases. It combines the Ming Yu Wu database from 2002 and then PCAOB's kind of own internal database. And one concern that I had is unless both of those databases use the exact same approach in building the database, differences across periods could be due to different protocols and database construction. So if they are constructed in exactly the same way, you just need to say that in the paper. If they're not constructed in the same way, then you need to think through what the potential implications of that are. The other thing is your initial sample is like 1,700 observations, and you exclude what you describe in the paper as non-overlapping restatement announcements, or you exclude overlapping, so you're left with a non-overlapping sample, which is 518. And you do this for statistical reasons. But one thing, there's always trade-offs in these choices, right? Because now what you have is you've lost two-thirds of the original sample. And so then a concern that I always have, and I know a lot of times academics get nervous when you exclude big chunks of the population, particularly if you exclude them for reasons other than the data doesn't exist, and that's not the reason you're excluding these, is your remaining sample essentially representative of the population from which it was drawn? And so you need to at least think about that.
Damon Silver?
I just wanted to urge you to pay particular attention to Ted White's comments. I thought that he embodied very, very clearly and precisely what I was trying to say somewhat vaguely earlier.
And I think the last card up was David Becker.
Just to the extent that you're looking at reasons for the change in the drift downward pre-announcement, I'd just point out that the SEC changed its 8K rules requiring announcement earlier, in effect. And I just sort of anecdotally, there. Before that, often clients would want to do is not make multiple announcements. And until you know what the number is that needs to be restated, or you want to have as much information as possible before going to the market. But the 8K rule said, no, as soon as you know that you are going to have to restate, you got to disclose.
Well, thank you all for the comments. I think Steve and Jan have gotten some very good input here. As I said in my opening comments, Steve and Jan have acknowledged that their normal process would be to have gone through channels that somebody referenced earlier of seminars and publication for peer review, which they intend to do. We also wanted to get the input of this SAG, and we felt that when they went through looking for peer review, the fact that it was a PCAOB economist doing the study, it would get out regardless, and we thought it would at least get out in the sunshine via this fashion here today. So thank you very much for those comments.
Okay, we want to turn to the last agenda item today, which is emerging issues and wrap up. Several SAG members suggested that we sort of do an updating, if you will, of our last emerging issue in June with regard to the subprime lending situation as well as the current liquidity situation in the market. And to sort of kick off that discussion, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Olson, who has a few remarks he'd like to make, and then Marty Bowman is going to also update us with regard to several matters.
Just very briefly, we talked a little bit about it. The issue was starting to emerge, although the signs had been around for a long time, but it's really started to emerge at the last SAG. And in the intervening months, of course, it's become a major issue, and as Fed chairman said, it's going to have a huge impact on the economy and a continuing impact on the economy for some period of time. Marty and his group have been giving us regular updates on some of the issues, and while there are a world of issues that we could spend enough time so that all of you would miss your flights, we thought it would be useful just as an educational opportunity and to just highlight some of the accounting and auditing implications that we've seen and that we've been following and keeping track of. So with that background, Marty, back to you.
All right, thanks. Thanks very much, Mark. As Mark said, at the last SAG meeting, we did open up the floor for discussion about the subprime developments and reactions that SAG members had from a accounting or auditing perspective. Since that time, the subprime crisis has certainly led to a larger liquidity and credit contractions in the marketplace much more broadly, and really into the identification of significant risks in various investment vehicles that some may not have really understood were there before. And I think many of us have read terms in the paper and different types of structured investment vehicles that we hadn't really focused on or heard too much about in the past. From the PCAOB perspective, we have been actively discussing these risks throughout 2007 in our regular meetings of something we call the Audit Risk Working Group, which includes PCAOB representatives, senior technical partners from the audit firms that are inspected annually, and senior staff from the Center for Audit Quality. We've also participated in conversations with the accounting firms, SEC staff, FASB, and banking regulatory agencies regarding the accounting and auditing issues emanating from these current market conditions. Also, our inspections teams certainly have considered these risks in both their inspections of certain 2006 audits taking place during 2007 and in planning for the 2008 inspection cycle. As many of you are probably aware or might be aware, the accounting profession, through the CAQ, issued three white papers intended to interpret existing GAAP with respect to certain of the accounting issues highlighted by the current market conditions. The white papers dealt with measurements of fair value in illiquid or these less liquid markets. And there was a lot of discussion and controversy around that as to how much the extent to which thin trading should be taken account of in valuing financial instruments. And so the discussions that took place earlier about fair value were very, very pertinent during this most recent quarter. And a white paper dealt with the subject of how to deal with information in the marketplace in getting those fair values. Another white paper dealt with the consolidation of commercial paper conduits. And again, a very challenging area dealing with FIN 46R, which was the accounting standard that came out to deal with really special purpose entities in the post-Enron environment. I think it's still fair to say that dealing with the consolidation of these of entities that aren't really owned by anybody and is still a very complicated issue, and the white paper addressed possible reconsideration that might have to take place of consolidation of these conduits when market conditions change. And then there was a third white paper on accounting for underwriting and loan commitments. A very large number of loan commitments were made in connection with a lot of the private equity deals, et cetera. Some numbers in the neighborhood of $360 billion of commitments that had to be funded in the third and fourth quarters are numbers that I had heard about, and the white paper dealt with how those commitments should be accounted for. In many cases, the values of those commitments had deteriorated. So again, while the current market conditions create significant uncertainty for investors and lenders, they've also surfaced some extremely complex accounting issues that preparers and auditors have had to deal with during 2007 and during the third quarter. So overall at PCAOB, we're closely monitoring these current market conditions, which create an environment certainly of elevated accounting risk, and we'll issue additional audit guidance if we believe it's needed. So with that introduction, I wanted to open up the floor to receive input from SAG members on your perspectives on this credit and liquidity crisis and any observations you might have for us. And I'll start with Cynthia Richland.
Actually, this is a question for Tom. Has FASB got any plans to take a look at 46R and think about revising it? It's kind of surprising to investors, you know, after the Enron debacle that we would again have off-balance sheet, non-transparent, non-disclosed entities of this magnitude.
At this point, we don't have any plans to revisit 46R. We've been looking at the issue just recently to try to understand whether or not non-consolidation was the appropriate accounting, giving accounting standards for the conduits. I think we consider that there are significant issues with the backups that's explicit and implicit that were in the sponsoring banking organizations that might suggest consolidation may have been needed and didn't occur. So if that's the case and we confirm that significantly, then it isn't one of a 46R problem. It is more one of application of 46R.
Ellen Turner.
I commend you, Marty, for staying on top of this and working, because I think, as Mark mentioned, this is a big issue, and this is going to be with us for a while, and perhaps could grow even bigger. You mentioned you met with the CAQ and the Big Four and all. Have you met at all with the credit rating agencies to get some flavor for what they're seeing and what they're concerned about, as well as whether or not they feel they're getting all the disclosure and information? Obviously, they got the right by contract to get certain data if they're the rating agency that's getting paid. But I'd encourage you to meet with the credit rating agencies just to see what they think they need that they aren't already getting. And clearly, they're on record in the public, in some public venues, as saying they felt like they were getting all the information they should have been getting, and that impacted the quality of their credit ratings. So it would be, I think, worthwhile to go pursue that and find out what it was that they weren't getting that they needed. The SIV thing that Linsmeyer just mentioned, my experience in looking at some of these was when you really drilled down into the documents, there were usually trapdoors or triggers built into them that would cause you concern about whether or not they should be consolidated. And we would find those, and it almost seemed like as if the audit partner had never dug down into those and didn't realize that they were there. And so I think it's very much so worthwhile pursuing those and whether or not those needed to be consolidated. Also, and a question for Zoe, right after Fin 46 and then Fin 46R evolved. Yeah. And, I know there was a lot of consulting with the SEC and OCA on these. Did OCA take any positions with respect to consolidation of these SIVs that may be now coming back to have an impact on what's going on? I certainly think it would be worthwhile turning around and taking a look at that. And the last thing is, I met yesterday morning with an analyst who has pulled the filings of several dozen of these great big ones, and he's gone through the footnotes and disclosure, and he found the FIN 46 disclosure in about half the filings, and in half the filings there was no such disclosure. So it does look like a number of these filings have been able to get through and get by the audit and review without complying fully with FIN 46. And if that's the case, I'd certainly encourage you, especially in light of what we're hearing about from the rating agencies about not having enough data, I'd certainly ask that you look at that, and if that's what we find to be the case, you know, why and how is it on something that's having such a major impact on this economy? Can we sit there and allow those financials to go out with a clean bill of health?
Thank you for those comments and that insight, Lynn.
Lynn, just a quick follow-up question. Were those the filings of the investment vehicles or the sponsors?
The sponsors.
The sponsors, thank you.
So the filings, the companies like Citigroup and whoever had sponsored the CIVs.
Damon Silvers.
There's been some discussion, less in auditing and accounting circles and more in other places, about sort of in the who's to blame category that has focused on the question of the behavior of holders of this paper in different types of financial institutions. And I wondered if in the board's work so far, just any differences in terms of foreign private issuers versus U.S. institutions around the accounting treatment of asset-backed paper.
We really can't, I don't think, talk about any of our inspections processes, as I think you're aware. It's fair to say that, as I said, our inspections are taking note of these issues that I addressed, both with respect to 2006 audits that they're inspecting now and are planning for the 2008 cycle.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I guess hearing no more comment on that, I guess we'll bring this meeting to a close. Once again, it's been very productive. I really want to thank all of you for your active participation and your advice. Unless we call a special meeting between now and the end of the year, this will have been the last SAG meeting of this year. And some of you, of course, will not be joining us next year, because your terms will have expired. I know some of you have been nominated for another term, and the board will be announcing the new SAG members by the end of this month, so stay tuned. I do want to especially thank those members who have just completed a term, and for those of you who won't be returning, please stay in touch, and if you have any advice for us, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know. Thank you, and the meeting's adjourned.